This is Ahmed Zappa. You're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology, the fucking best show there is.
DIY and How Studios presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Hello, diggers. Welcome to another edition of Deeper Digs in Rock. Christian Swain here. I am the rock and roll archaeologist, and I'm behind the mic in San Francisco today. All right, this week's news. Over the last few weeks, I've been telling you that this show, Deeper Digs in Rock, and the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcast are telling of the history of rock and roll and how music, culture, and technology wove together to create one of the most explosive and expansive art movements in human history are available in their own podcast feeds. So those are now there for fans of one or both of these shows. You don't have to go to the Big Pipe and listen to all the shows if you don't want to, although we highly suggest that you do. There are great shows all the way around, but we know there are fans of certain shows, and so we've begun to pull some of them out into their own feeds. Just choices. You can pick that to listen to individually, or you can always go to the Big Pipe and just listen to the shows that you want to listen to. Hopefully you are a super fan and listen to them all. Okay, so there is another piece to that puzzle. We've entered into a partnership with our friends over at the Osiris Podcasting Network. It's a global community connecting passionate music fans with podcasts about music, artists, and culture. Go check out their wonderful set of shows along with Deeper Digs in Rock and the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast at osirispod.com. Yeah, not too dissimilar to what we are doing with the Pantheon Podcasts. Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. As was said at the end of Casablanca. All right, that's the headlines. Stay classy, San Diego. Okay. Finally, and this is the one that matters most to us. If you enjoy what we do here, then please tell a friend about all the shows that you dig on Pantheon Podcasts. Hey, on Osiris. Hey, just the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast, or this one, Deeper Digs in Rock. You can write about it. You can put a review in. iTunes is great, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a note. Contact us on social media. All of that. Okay. All right. Thank you. We really appreciate you just listening in. That takes care of the housekeeping. So let's meet today's guest. So this week we go deep into the technology side of our story of rock and roll. As we've said numerous times, technology has as much to do with making rock and roll into the global phenomenon it became as culture or any other ingredient. David Frangione is known as the technologist for rock stars. He's worked with over 200 in the studio for live purposes and even home theaters. He is most famously known for working first with his hometown heroes Aerosmith and then was a part of Ozzy's team during the Osbournes reality show. He is the owner of Audio One of South Florida, and he also runs his Frangione Foundation. A part of that foundation is a museum dedicated to drums, famous drums. Drums like Carl Palmer's stainless steel drum kit, one of Hal Blaine's Wrecking Crew sets, Ginger Baker's sets, Zach Starkey's from the Super Bowl. Lots of drums. And guess what? He's put them all in a book. Crash, the world's greatest drum kits from A Piece to Van Halen. Out now from our friends at Inside Editions and in association with Modern Drummer. So, without further ado, let's get to know David Frangione. Honey, what have you done? No, no, it's the sound of my gun. Honey, honey, what have you done? No, no, it's the sound. Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, David Frangione. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, okay, first question, David. More than anything else, you're known as a technologist in the music industry. So tell our diggers what that means today and how you got there. I mean, why the technical side?
Well, technology is so vast, and I define being a technologist as someone who handles all things technology in the music making process or music playback process. So, for example, I got here first being a drummer, starting to play the drums at age 2. When I was 2 years old, I was diagnosed with retinoblastoma, which is cancer of the eye. Yeah. The end result was the removal of my right eye at age 2, going through that trauma and finding music and drumming as my refuge. And don't ask me why the drums, because at 2 years old, I'm not sure there's really an explanation. As my youth continued on, I got more and more passionate about the drums. It became more and more of an outlet that really inspired me, and started, you know, playing live, taking lessons, and having a very abnormal childhood in the sense that playing the drums and playing out as a young age, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, was how I spent my childhood. And it was great as an escape, doing something you love and kind of getting out of the torment of dealing with all the things I'd been dealing with, having the one eye, being a kid, going through the cancer, you know, other kids could be really cruel. Mm-hmm. And then I found technology as a drummer. I was pursuing wanting to be the world's greatest drummer. And in doing that, I was finding more and more that music and drumming required a knowledge of not only drum machines, but how electronics integrated with a modern drum kit at the time, modern being the mid-80s. And it just led me further and further into the electronics world as it relates to drumming, and then, you know, soon
probably
after.
MIDI, I'm sure.
Totally, MIDI. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I started... I found that I love technology and music even more than I love drumming and music, if it was possible. Mm-hmm. And I started a MIDI consulting business. I'm from Boston. So in Boston, I put together a business, and I had an 800 number, 1-800-345-MIDI. And a very early supporter of mine was Gene Jolly, who ran EU Wurlitzer, which was a 5-store chain at the time around New England. Chuck Surak was just starting Sweetwater Sound. He's still
You grew up in the Boston area.
I grew up in the Boston area, and Gene was local, of course, to the area, and was a leader in the music retail business. And so he had a lot of clients coming in buying equipment, but he didn't have support staff. In those days, you know, technology was so new, you wouldn't even really think of having a support staff. I mean, we're still in the 80s.
Yeah, it's just instruments and then drum machines and then like the DX7, and unless you could afford like a Synclavier or something like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. The Synclav and the Fairlight being the end of the frame at that time, being the big boys, which you bought direct. Right. And then all of the equipment you'd buy in music stores, like you just described, there really wasn't any kind of support mechanism. So I approached Gene and I said,
it's like the TR-808, I think everybody had one of those, right?
Yeah. Iconic drum machine. Yeah. And I approached Gene and said, you know, could I be the in-house support for EU Wurlitzer, do all of your MIDI support? And he said, well, you know, in-house, no, because we don't have a slot on our payroll to bring you in. But you start a business, or at that time I had a business, but he said, you take your business and you plug it into our machine and we will support you and exclusively refer you. So I made up some laminated signs, posters with little business card holders, put my 1-800-345-MIDI business cards in the, you know, in the business card holders, brought them to all the stores he had, introduced myself to his staff, and a lot of referrals and people started calling me. And so I started to build that consulting business up. Now, as we go through the years, you know, what MIDI, what technologist is today for me, and it's, you know, obviously over 30 years, it's I've evolved it. And now it means putting together studios, entire facilities, entire systems, whether they're for recording, mixing, playback, whether they're for live, putting together a system for tour, anything basically that touches on technology, but it's extremely vast by definition today.
Yeah. So we caught a little bit of the superhero origin story of David Frangione. You had cancer when you were 2 years old in your right eye. And do you think that made you push harder than other kids as you were growing up?
Absolutely. And on top of that, my parents were really, they were incredibly loving and supportive, but they were really strong. And they pushed very hard for me to, you know, you and I have talked about the Patriots a little bit. You know, I'm an avid Patriot.
Oh, in our green room session. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, we did. And one of Bill Belichick's famous sayings, for those that know the NFL or have at least heard this, it's called No Days.
Of course, you know, we've just lost half our audience, but sure, go ahead.
Okay, well, sorry about that, guys. I'm not boasting for the Patriots.
It's a small moment in sports, right?
I'm making a point that there's a saying called No Days Off.
Yeah.
And No Days Off is really, it defines my parents' approach to life and work. Mm. And they really taught me to approach it that way. And I'm not saying it's the best thing for everybody because it's intense, but you get results. And when you apply the education of learning what it is that you're doing and taking a very learned approach to it, so not only you know, immersing yourself, but studying and learning and growing and then working really hard at it and seizing every opportunity to do what you love and build a career from it. That was my approach. And it's definitely, I know they pushed me that hard, not only because they wanted me to be successful at whatever I put my mind to, but they also felt, you know, there was a bond among us that if you looked at it from one standpoint, you might call it sad or somber, but there was a bond among us like, hey, this kid's been through hell. And, you know, nobody can really make any sense out of why or, you know, how you deal with it. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to kind of, I think they always looked at me as like the underdog, and they just wanted to give me as much support as they could to kind of rise above.
Wow. So by 16, you began to focus more behind the curtain than in front of it. So professionally, right, in the music scene, I believe it kind of all starts with some hometown heroes from Boston, and that being Aerosmith.
Yes, which started in 89.
So did Steven Tyler like call you in the middle of the night and demand immediate attention?
Soon after working with him, he did, and still does, which is a blessing. But no, the Aerosmith connection started with Tom Hamilton, the bass player, reaching out to me first, and he had a MIDI rig at his house and a sequencer on a computer with an 8-track analog recorder, and everything was synchronized, and he had some keyboards and drum machines, and he used it as a writing system. And he called me up and asked me if I could come over to his house and help him with it. And after a few weeks of working together, and he was starting to make progress on it, we got along real well, and I think he could see, that I could not only help him with his system, but I understood all the technology really well. And he called me up one day, and I want to say it's kind of out of the blue sky. I thought he was going to call and ask for another session because we had already done a few, and then there was this little break, and I thought that when he called again, I'd go back and I'd work with him again. And of course, I was very excited because I'm a huge Aerosmith fan. Been an Aerosmith fan since I was literally 9 years old. Right after I started playing the drums and taking lessons at 8, I discovered Aerosmith, and I was just a huge fan. And so he called this time and he said, "Hey, the band is working on this record and then subsequent tour called Pump. And we, I was talking with the guys, and you might be able to help. I'm not really sure." And he was very kind, but he was also very cautious. Like in his own way, he was saying, like, "I'm not offering you a gig with the band. I'm offering you an opportunity to come and meet them and see if there's a fit. And, right, wherever it goes from here, it goes."
Right, right.
Which was an incredible, incredible, incredible offer. And so he didn't even finish bringing it up, and I was literally asking him for directions to where, where are we meeting? The band's rehearsing. Okay, great. I got it. Where? And so it turns out they were rehearsing at a rehearsal facility right behind Fenway Park in Boston. So, nice. If you haven't abandoned,
everybody knows where that is.
Please don't abandon it now, okay? This isn't about the Red Sox or the Patriots. This is about Aerosmith. So I'm always early. In fact, I think I got there even before the guy that opens the door to the rehearsal facility.
Of course.
I get in there, and I'm waiting, and there's a waiting room at where the entrance is, and then there's the rehearsal room, and you have to walk through the waiting room to get to the rehearsal room. So my heart's beating. It was such an exciting moment. And of course, at this point, I'd only met Tom Hamilton. So now I'm going to get to meet the other guys. And it's kind of interesting. It's like the band, it's 5 members. They've been together for all these years. They'll be celebrating their 50th year soon.
Mm-hmm.
In most bands, the lead singer is the most famous guy. The lead guitarist is kind of the second most famous guy. It kind of, goes.
It just goes with the territory. Yeah,
exactly. So not commenting on anything about that other than just to recall the story of that day in my life. The band members started showing up one at a time. And like the first guy there was like Brad Whitford, the rhythm guitarist, and comes in, and I'd never met him before, of course. I'd never seen him up close like that. It was like so exciting, and didn't really know who I was, just kind of was pleasant, walked by. Then Tom came, and of course, he was very gracious, and he's like, wait for everybody else to get here, and then when we're ready, we'll bring you in. And I said, "Oh, great, Tom, thank you very much." Then Joey Kramer, the drummer, shows up, and of course that was really exciting, being a drummer, being an Aerosmith fan. And then there's a little bit of a break, and the entourage is starting to get a little bit bigger, and the rest of the crew is getting there, and it's starting to get a little more active and even more exciting, and I'll even say a little chaotic. And then Joe Perry walks in.
Ooh, yeah.
And, he's in amazing shape, which he's been in for, like, at this point, the whole time I've known him.
Prototypical gunslinger, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ripped with a leather vest and no shirt and, the whole thing. Just cool as you could ever imagine. And he comes in and very, he's an amazing man, very nice man. And he was, he just kind of looked at me, walked by, that didn't really, whatever, we had never met. And then there's another little pause in time, and I'm hearing the band warm up now, and I'm starting to hear, Aerosmith riffs and the guys turning the amps on, and the power of that band, right? Like you're it's like hearing those riffs from 20 feet away at that volume, even just warming up and getting ready. Like, it was really building up momentum and excitement for me. And then in the distance, I hear the only way I can describe this is I hear what sounded like a bull rush. It's going to get closer and closer. I mean, it was almost frightening. And I just
the tornado.
Exactly. And it's getting closer and bigger and louder.
Like the Tasmanian devil.
Yep.
Right. And, from the Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Exactly. And lo and behold, coming through the door with probably 10 people surrounding him, and Steven Tyler, barking orders and, answering questions. And I mean, it was just completely over the top. And he's moving at a clip, and there's assistants and publicists and security and like just a whole entourage following every step that he's taken. And he's looking around and pointing and signing and talking. And it was incredible. And of course, I was a huge Steven Tyler fan, and here he is in the flesh, and he walks by, and we make eye contact, and he was like, looked at me. He's like, "Who are you?" And I said, "Oh, Tom invited me here today. I'm here to, to work with you and whatever you need that has to do with technology." And kind of his eyebrow went up, and he was just kind of like, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, whenever you're ready." He's like, "Let's go." And I go into the room, and he's getting situated and putting his his maracas and all his stuff, he has his corner that he's, got all set up, and he had a keyboard there and some other stuff. So I set up my sequencer and a bunch of things, and we just start gelling like we've known each other for 100 years. And he is literally like, just starts saying, "Hey, can we do this? Can we do that?" And yes, 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 no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes. And we start recording a MIDI sequence of one of the overdub parts for Janie's Got a Gun.
Yeah.
First thing I did was
They're making the song right there.
They're putting together the playback of the song. And the song, so the song on the record, the song had a synthesized bass and Tom playing a real bass. Mm-hmm. And there was a patch that they used on the Korg M1 as the synthesized bass, as the other bass part. And Steven played that into the sequencer so that when they played the song back, they would have all the parts to it. So we had to send Joey a click and, record the bass part and he would start playing it and, he'd hit a note and want to play it again. And I'd just go back a couple of bars, and the process went so fast that, a 5-minute song we recorded in like 6 minutes. And wow. So, because Steven could play it through, he just had a couple of spots that he wanted to tighten up. Mm-hmm. And he was just blown away. The thing about Steven is he's such a genius that he has so many ideas. The key is to keep up with him. So, don't slow him down either because of the technology itself or because of how you can use the technology. Always make sure that the archer and the arrow can keep up with Steven. And I learned that right there in real time in 5 minutes. And thank God I had studied and worked hard enough prior to this opportunity that I was ready for it. So as he was saying, if we can do this, then how about that? And if we can do that, then how about these? And as that's going on, he was able to just keep going. And that's really what clicked.
Oh, you proved your worth immediately.
Well, fortunately, and we got along great, right? Because you got to have the chemistry, that X factor. It's like you could be good at doing something, but do people want to be around you? And do you make the process and the environment better than without you?
Yeah.
Right? That famous saying, some people are, some people are happy to see you wherever you go, and some people are happy to see you whenever you go. And so it's one of those things that this was like, wherever you go kind of mode. And it was great. And Steven looked at me, and within like a half an hour, he starts giving me nicknames, which is a real, you know, as I would learn later on, that was a sign of affection. Like I was earning a couple of stripes, like, you know, from day one. So he looks at me and he goes, I'm going to call you Gyro Gearloose. No, actually, I'm going to call you Swervo Gizmo. Actually, I'm going to call you one or the other. So I've been working and like, you know, I'm still kind of getting used to it. It's day one and I'm working on something and he's like, Gyro. And to this day, I am in his cell phone as Gyro. If when I call him or text him, the name comes up G-Y-R-O. That was in 1989, the first day that we met, that he gave me that nickname. And Swervo Gizmo didn't stick around so long, but Gyro Gearloose.
Gyro Gearloose.
30 years this November, I think it was. And so of 89. And that's how the band started for me. And then I became their in-house engineer, built studios for them. And when they would go into pre-production, I would, you know, run the studio and, you know, be there every day so they could just focus on writing and music and dealing with whoever was going to co-write, which sometimes writers would come in. And then when they were on tour, I would help them with, on-tour technology, and I would help them with stuff that was happening while they were going a million miles an hour. So like the radio spots, we would record all the – you know, all the lines for the radio IDs. And then, you know, they'd go out on tour and, you know, they'd need a cut of Dude Looks Like a Lady for Mrs. Doubtfire. So I'd go in the studio and cut it up and, you know, send it to Geffen. Or, you know, it was just, there was always something going on in the Aerosmith world. And when I, you know, when things kind of slowed down in the early 2000s after Just Push Play and they were primarily touring, I look back and, you know, Pump, Get a Grip, Big Ones You Can Look At, Self Insanity, Nine Lives, Just Push Play, all those iconic videos and just everything, the amusement park ride, like all these things that happened, the 50 million plus records of those, just those titles at that time. Like it was just, it's amazing. I look back at it and I just go, you know, every day we went to work, we tried to create the best music that we could and always stay tried and true to Aerosmith. And I was a guy behind the scenes, just making sure that those guys could be Steven and Joe and the rest of the band and kick ass. And lo and behold, like a lot of amazing music and moments came out of that. And just really, you know, just once in a lifetime and just really blessed.
You know, you mentioned you have worked with a lot of famous musicians, many names. We don't have to go through them all, but a lot of our diggers might know you as the official technologist for the Osbournes TV show.
Yeah,
how'd that come about? I guess Ozzy calls you the, so you have a couple of different nicknames now, because I can think Ozzy calls you the Rocket Man, right?
Yes, yeah, Ozzy and Sharon and the family's amazing. That came about because I built studios. Most of my clients, I've built more than one studio for, thank goodness. As they move homes or, you know, change whatever they're doing, they, you know, a studio has a certain lifespan, you know, even no matter how it's done. So Mark Hudson, we had a few different studios for, and he started working with Ozzy. And Ozzy said to him,
"Oh, Mark Hudson from the Hudson Brothers,
exactly,
the producer, right?
Yes, exactly. Who produced and co-wrote a bunch of Ringo Starr records?
Yep,
in the 90s and 2000s, right? So he started working with Ozzy around 2002, and Ozzy said to him, 'I want to build a studio at my house. I've never had a studio before.' Which you think about Ozzy and Black Sabbath in his career, it's hard to believe he never had a studio." But he didn't. And he was talking to Mark, and Mark said, "Well, look, I've got the guy to build it for you." And then Ozzy and his team kind of asked around. And as Ozzy told me later, he goes, "Dave, this is like a joke, man. It's like everybody I ask, I say, oh,
hey, like, you have spent some time with him.
Oh, yeah.
You sound just like him.
Who would you hire, man? And every single person would say to me, 'Dave Frangione. It's like a joke.'" And so he was like really nice and complimentary about it. So lo and behold, he called me. he actually called me personally. And I was sitting at an Italian restaurant, Sal's Ristorante, which was this local Italian dive that I went to sometimes. I still order takeout from him. And I'm sitting there with some guys who worked with me, right? It was always work, right? So it's like 9 o'clock at night, and we're having an after work dinner meeting in 2003. And the phone rings, and of course it's 6 p.m. Pacific, where Ozzy is, and it was at the time. And I get I answer the phone, and it's a private number. I answer the phone, and could you hold for Mr. Osborne, please? And I think it's a joke. So I'm like, yeah, sure, I can hold for Mr. Osborne.
Or just Mr. Osborne of whatever, right.
Right? Because Jeffrey, Ozzy.
Yeah.
So he, so lo and behold, I go, Dave. And I'm thinking to myself, and I had watched the show because it had already been on two seasons. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is Ozzy. Again, another hero, Blizzard of Oz. You know, I tried to get tickets to the concert when Randy Rhoads was still with him and before that tragedy. And like, I was a huge fan, had every Black Sabbath record, had every Ozzy record as well. But Blizzard of Oz was like, you know, life changing for me. And then Diary of a Madman came out right after, another incredible, iconic record. So here he is on the phone. And we go through this whole back and forth about, you know, what he wants for his studio. And the next thing you know, I'm flying out to L.A. a couple days later, and I'm meeting with him, and I'm at the house where the show is being filmed. That's where we met, and he's taken me through it. And he hired me on the spot, and he had Ozfest that summer. So he had, like, called me, I think, like around June of 03. And then that whole summer he was going to do Ozfest. So what we set as a goal was I was going to build it during the summer. And then when he got back off of Ozfest, it'd be ready for him because he'd have a break. And then he'd go into studio mode and he'd be able to, you know, just get in the groove and we could make whatever changes he wanted in the studio, et cetera. So it turns out that at the tail end of building the studio, season three of the Osbournes was starting to film. So by default, you know, anybody at the house who's, you know,
ends up being on camera.
You're signing the release and you're on camera. Well, it turns out that they did a lot of segments about, you know, what was going on in the house with the studio. And then Sharon and Ozzy asked me to fix all the technology in their house that was the home side of it. So I'm building the studio in their guest house, which was next to the pool, that rock pool that you saw all the time on the show that was in the backyard. So the far end of the backyard was this guest house. You actually didn't really see it until they built the studio in it. Mm. But then the main house, they had all these touch screens controlling all the televisions, and they had a lighting control system, and they had all kinds of gadgets, and none of it worked. So they had me fix it. And they even did some segments where I was, you know, they were doing a gag on, you know, how it worked before I fixed it and how I got it to work after. And they were just really gracious, amazing people, supportive, kind, incredible. And of course, Ozzy's talent is without, you know, there's no words to describe his talent and his sense of humor and his humanity. I mean, what a guy. Just the heart of gold and just an amazing person, amazing talent. And another inspiration, you know, like with Steven, you're in the studio with
Ozzy. Well, they are definitely a power couple, the two of them.
Oh, yeah. And in the studio with Ozzy and working with him, because after the studio was done, he did a couple of records and he did an MTV Christmas special with Jessica Simpson. They recorded Winter Wonderland. And we were doing really cool, significant things in the studio, like the day it was ready. And so it was a really, really amazing time. And then they moved out of the Osborne's house. So I was on seasons 3 and 4, you know, and when I say on it, I mean, you know, I was around and I was in some of the shots or episodes or whatever. I mean, you know, but then they moved a few years later and we built another studio for them at their new home. And it was an incredible time.
I can imagine. Okay. First off the wall question, since I just got back from NAMM, what is the hottest technology product that has you most excited today? What's the thing everybody should be looking into?
Well, you know, that's a great question. It depends what are we talking about in what area?
Because, what's the first thing that popped in your mind?
Well, my main place is studio recording, mixing. That's always where I look first, because that's where I spend the most time building studios or facilities. And live and touring tend to be more secondary.
Right. I guess I should ask, were you at NAMM this year?
No, I was actually going to be. I was at NAMM the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. I have a herniated disc in my back. Isn't that crazy? It's the first, it's the first injury I've really had in since my cancer. I've been so lucky and so blessed. I'm a really healthy person. But unfortunately, I think I was working out too hard around Thanksgiving and in the gym, and this happened. So I've been sidelined in terms of the normal running around that I do for traveling and clients and whatnot. So NAMM had to, you know, wasn't so crucial that I went. And again, like you said earlier about technology and the tools that we have to kind of bring everybody together virtually, NAMM's a perfect example. I saw the big things at NAMM from my desktop.
Right.
Every day, there's incredible coverage between the app and the online and the socials and all the manufacturers that were, you know, out there touting.
Doing their thing, right.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, it was firsthand. But to answer your question, in the studio world, I think one of the things that I'm really excited about is the new Chris Lord Alge Waves plugin Mix Hub. He's got this plugin that basically takes what you do on a traditional console, and he brought the workflow into a digital audio workstation. Mm-hmm. And it's a plugin. But
so like the next generation of, say, Pro Tools or something like that?
Well, it works within Pro Tools and all the other DAWs. But what mm-hmm. it does is next gen is bring you up to speed with actually a tried and true workflow. The workflow is actually not new, but the ability to get inside of a legendary and incredible mixing engineer such as Chris Lord Alge, get into his workflow. And a lot of great engineers have similar workflows, right? I've worked with a lot of them, and they, you know, everybody's got their own way of doing things. But when you can get inside of Chris's way and you can understand it and you utilize it and you can really get it down, you're going to speed up your work and get better results, and it's going to be significant. So that's where a tool really, you know, I always say it's the archer and not the arrow, and I really believe that. But if you can get a better arrow, which means that your shot that was already good is now going to be very consistent and maybe even a little bit better because, you know, the arrows are a little more, you know, strong.
Mature, a little straighter.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's where – and that to me what is what all these tools represent, the mm-hmm. better arrows. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and so this is something that without a doubt, you know, is a great addition. I'm pretty excited about it.
All right. Okay, so before we get to the drums and this fantastic coffee table book, Crash, the World's Greatest Drum Kits, I want to ask another slightly off-the-wall question. Well, to tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I kind of lost track of the question myself. So I'm not sure if I asked 5 or 6 questions. So, David, you have to ask yourself one question. Do you feel lucky?
Oh, I love it.
Well, I feel lucky.
2 Clint Eastwood books. And a picture holding the first book back when we did it in 09. And we just 3 days ago got a picture of Clint holding Crash and holding the new Icon. So I've got Clint Eastwood, my lifelong film hero, right? I've never, believe it or not, I've never really followed his personal life very much. But as a film actor, I am a diehard true fan of him, his movies and his characters. And he's holding all 3 of my books, 2 of which he was involved in.
That's amazing. Now, I believe I've read you have more than 10,000 pieces of Clint Eastwood memorabilia.
I have a big collection of it.
Isn't that more than Mr. Eastwood has in his own home?
Well, it probably is. You know what the funny thing is? There's a girl at Warner Brothers named Diana Ahn Friedman who has worked in the philanthropy department of Warner for quite some time. She's a friend of mine, not just a friend, but an amazing person. Amazing, amazing, amazing. And she really facilitated taking my vision of a Clint Eastwood film art poster book and made the connection with Clint himself.
Uh-huh.
She really, yeah, she and Justin Lee, who is like a brother to me, lives in LA as well, were really the catalyst. And so the other day, she went to Clint's office on the Warner lot to deliver Crash and the new Icon. And she knocks on the door and Clint answers. And she ends up having a 30-minute dialogue. He remembered her because she was the facilitator of the first Icon back in 2008. 2009 is when it was released, but we worked on it in both years. And she hasn't really seen him much since, just saw him on the lot a couple of times here and there. But now here she's back in the office with the updated version of Icon and the new book, Crash. And as a lot of people know, Clint's a musician. And
yeah,
he loves
a big jazz lover. Yeah. Right. I mean, play Misty for me and all that. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And Bird. Yeah. And just all, oh, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he sees Crash and he immediately says to her, you know, oh, my God, Buddy Rich. You know, he was a friend of mine and, you know, it's so cool. And so he's really digging it. And Diana, now this is unscripted, and I don't know Diana's going to his office that day, and I have not prepped Diana on anything to say about anything. She goes to the back of the Icon book, and to speak to the question and point you just made, because it's just priceless that this just happened. She goes to the back of the Icon book and says, "Mr. Eastwood, do you have any of these items on David's want list?" They're all Clint Eastwood movies, right? And I'm thinking, Diana, what are you doing? Yeah. That's not for him. That's for the collecting world. And so he's such a great guy, and he took it really fun. And he goes, I don't even have any of these things. And so it was just priceless. So whether you knew it or not, yes, I have more items than Clint Eastwood. It's official.
Yeah, that's another big passion of yours is Clint Eastwood fan. All right, just a real quick favorite movie.
My goodness, that's a tough one. It was Dirty Harry up until Gran Torino. And now it's kind of a toss up between the two, but I have to go Dirty Harry, but it's really impossible for me to pick one because again, you know, like technology, like music, it's like people say favorite band. They ask me that all the time. And I have to pick one, I say Led Zeppelin. Mm-hmm. But really, like, to pick the Beatles or Led Zeppelin, it's not really the same thing, you know? It's like they're different. They're so different. It's like...
Yeah, well, some days you want vanilla, some days you want chocolate, and some days you want strawberry.
Exactly, and that's the flavor you like best that day.
Yeah.
So, you know, but the point is that with Clint, you know, to me, Good, Bad, Ugly, best of the three spaghetti westerns.
Give me Sergio Leone any day. So, but
right, exactly. Yeah. And to me, Bronco Billy, I love Unforgiven. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Outlaw Josie Wales.
Oh yeah. We could go on forever. Yes.
Right.
But this is about drums, so we have to jump off. We'll have you back, and we'll talk Clint someday. So
looking forward.
But that is a really neat thing. Yeah. So, all right, the book Crash. How and why did it come about?
Well, it came about because the Clint Eastwood books were first Icon in 2009, then Icon Revised and Expanded. And I wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to Raoul Goff, who's the, you know, the principal of Insight Editions, which is the book company that I'm signed with. Mm-hmm. Yep, publisher. And he just said, David, I want you to feed me ideas. And I will, you know, what do you want to do? What's your passion? What would you love? And I'll tell you when there's an idea that I really think there's an audience for. And so, of course, the first time around, that was Clint. And the second time around, that was the Clint Revised and Expanded, because thankfully the first book did well. And then right around the same time, though, that he gave me a green light to the second Icon is when I gave him a number of other ideas. And I have been pitching him ideas since Icon. So that's 2009.
Right.
And it was like, no. And, you know,
not a big enough audience. That'll never sell. Right.
Or the, you know, wrong time. Yeah. Or we just did a book very similar. You know, so all the usual stuff that happens when you have a publishing company and a lot of content happening. So Crash, he said, that's it. He goes, that's the book. And I was crazy enough to agree to put two books out less than 2 months apart.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
June 18 and August 14. I was like out of my mind. I didn't realize just how crazy I was about that until I was really into them and I'm going, oh, this is too much. So, but we did it. We were on time. Everything went well. And so that's how the beginning of it happened. But then the book itself, what I actually pitched them and what we release, which were really the same thing, was I wanted a book that I would want to look at every day as a drummer. Mm-hmm. And I want wanted it. I knew what I wanted it to be, but I also knew what I didn't want it to be. Because you go to the drum shows every year, like the biggest show is usually people consider the Chicago Drum Show every May to be kind of the biggest drum show.
Right.
And, you go there and there's dozens and dozens of books, and 99% of them are geek books. So you look, you know, you look at them and you go, okay, I can see all of the serial numbers that Slingerland released snare drums for in 1938, so I'll know if I have an original one or not. And I can see the brass plating changes that went into manufacturing from 1942 when the war was on to 1949. And like, it's all of that kind of stuff.
Not enough general education.
Not at all. And also not a book that you don't have to read.
Yeah.
That you can look at. Mm-hmm. To me, the definition of a coffee table book is, if you want to zone in on the captions or read some of the chapter, great. But more often than not, people want to enjoy something as visually great. And so I wanted to take you behind the kits that you've never been, in front of the kits, on top of the kits that you've never been. I wanted it's something for everyone, because if you are a drum geek, you're going to see the drums close up and personal that you've never seen before. They've never been photographed like that, certainly not by anybody like Mark Weiss, who's one of the greatest rock photographers in history, and he photographed every book in every drum kit in that book. Mm-hmm. in a studio in my museum.
Yep.
Where all the drums are set up, which is part of my Frangioni Foundation. So I basically, it's like a 360 view. It's like I'm going to take a great rock photographer who's photographed, you know, all my favorite bands. And I met him actually in person. I'd known about him for a long time, but we met in person because we were both traveling with Kiss. And so we were on their jet and we were at all their shows. And so we spent a lot of time together. And that's how the chemistry started. And I brought him into Crash. The timing of that week with Kiss and meeting Mark was perfect for when I needed to then start shooting the Crash photos.
Once again, the universe speaking.
Completely. Unscripted, and as it always is. And the next thing you know, we shot all the drum kits for the book, and it's this total experience of like, okay, we got the drums set up in the foundation, which is a private foundation where I can bring people for inspiration and for life-changing moments. We can do master classes, we can do all kinds of incredible things to give back to the community using the drums and the drummers. And then you've got the walk around the kits in the book, so you can experience. It's almost like the guidebook. If you walked around a museum, you go see the King Tut exhibit, like there's a nice book, right?
Yeah.
You can see it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of take that concept to the next level for people who will never see the museum, which is most people. And
because
and
it's invite only, right? It's
invite only. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have the book be I really wanted it to pay tribute to these drum kits that I felt were some of the most significant drum kits of their time. The funny thing is that there's not a rhyme or reason why specific kits. I could have approached the collection of kits very much like the Clint Eastwood collection, you know, where the Clint Eastwood collection is a completist collection. If it's a movie or a movie poster that I'm not necessarily really moved by, for the sake of having the book accurate and the collection right, the poster would be there.
Right.
And it's like, okay, you know, that's part of the history, and I'm not part of the creative team at Warner or at any whatever other film studio might have done a movie. So if that's what it looks like, that's what it is. But with the drums, they were all based on what I thought were significant in my life as a drummer, because mm-hmm. now my drumming life is 49 years old, right? I turned 51 last year. And so, you know, as an actual drummer, as a collector, I have tremendous experience. I started collecting baseball cards when I was 8, and I started my own business at flea markets when I was 9 called Card King, K-A-R-D, like how creative. And I would actually buy and sell baseball cards. I actually built that up to a very significant collection that I sold in the 90s at auction, when baseball cards were really coming into their own as a serious hobby.
Oh, really?
I left the hobby, but I sold the collection, and it was a very successful transaction because I'd built it up since the beginning. The point is, my collecting experience, you know, was pretty deep. And I got to know a lot of these drummers, and I got to hear them and work with them and understand them and help them with their drum technology or build studios for them. So all of these different tentacles to the drums brought to me, like, what are the drum sets that I, if I had all the money in the world, which I don't, what are the drum sets that I would want to keep historically significant, that I would want to share with people, that I would want to make sure are always like in great shape and preserved. And the book needed to capture that. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's only a fraction of the kits that I would love to have or love to find. But it was still a very significant undertaking. And it represents the kits, you know, like you look at the Greg Bissonette Eat 'Em and Smile kit from the David Lee Roth tour. You know, I was a huge fan. And in the moment of David Lee Roth leaving Van Halen at their peak,
yep,
then going to do a solo career that was just as big or bigger than Van Halen where he left, he brings in the right guys.
I mean, Greg Bissonette, Billy Sheehan, and Steve Vai.
Yeah. And they clicked, man. That band was on fire.
By the way, they got together at NAMM the other day. Other than David, but Diamond Dave. But,
right. Yeah. And I heard my friend Carlos Guzman, who's a great tour manager and drum technician, was at NAMM, and he sent me the clip on it.
Oh, yeah.
And he said to me instantly, he's such a great guy. He goes, he emails me, David, I know you're going to want to see this. So, and he was right. That would have been a reason to be at NAMM, by the way.
Yeah.
But I saw that I went to several shows on that tour, a huge fan. And I thought the kit was just so awesome, so fascinating. And the way that Pat Foley, who created that drum kit for Greg, you know, how he got that look where it really does look like cannonballs had shot through the drums,
right?
You know,
right.
It was just, and the drums sounded great too, but they looked so, and it was so unique. And you get up close and you see how he used almost like a tin foil metal so he could bend it. But I look at this kit and I think to myself, how did this kit go around the world for 2 years? Like, it's still in incredible shape, and it's so delicate, and there's so many little nuances to every drum shell and every little facet of it. It's one thing to keep it set up like we have it now. But it's another thing to think that this thing went in and out of road cases every night.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
For stainless steel kit, the cover kit of Crash.
Yeah.
That's the kit that got us to today.
Yeah.
Because when I was 8 years old, that was the drum kit that I fell in love with.
Okay, so Carl Palmer did write the foreword for the book. Was that your hero growing up? Was it Carl that you emulated?
Yes, it absolutely was. And Carl Palmer, who since has become a friend of mine, right, which is amazing. We did a drum duet together, and it's on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, he's doing a drum camp in November in Philadelphia that you're going to be able to go and work with him hands-on, and that is something everybody needs to go to. I'll tell you that right now, because I took a lesson with Carl the day after we did the drum duet at the Olympia Theater in Miami, which was June of 16. Mm-hmm. He blessed me with a lesson. I imagine a lesson with your hero, and he taught me so much in a few hours that I'm still practicing, and I'm not exaggerating. We're going on 2.5 years, and I'm still practicing what he showed me. So you got to go to this drum camp. But the point is that I get the Welcome Back record, and I look on the back of it, and there's this drum kit, this incredible live concert shot with Keith and Greg and Carl at the kit, and it's larger than life. And then I listen to the record, and the drums don't sound like anything I've ever heard. Of course, it's Carl's playing, but it's that concert tom stainless steel kit had such definition, but yet projection.
Mm-hmm.
That combined with his playing, which is really, really strong, and of course lightning fast. I never heard anything like it. And I hear the drum solo and Welcome Back, and I'm literally just somewhere between tears of absolute ecstatic joy and tears of why the hell am I ever thinking of picking up a pair of drumsticks.
Of course. Yes. So, we've all had those moments. Yeah.
Right? So I struggled with that for a long time. I probably still do. I still listen to the solo and can't play it. But the point is that it was pure inspiration. And I actually followed. And again, I can't tell you why. It's just something inside of me. I actually followed the lineage of that drum kit. So, and at the time, there's six channels of TV at the most, right? Yep. There's no cable TV.
Yeah, no internet. Yeah, yeah.
No internet. Yeah. Of course, no internet. No fax. Yeah. Forget internet. I don't even remember if it was FedEx at the time. But the point is, for media, you had rock magazines.
Yep.
And you had once in a blue moon TV, if you could even figure out when something was on. And what? Mm-hmm. So really, TV wasn't even really that big of a deal. And nobody sold videos at that time.
Not for gathering information, which is what the point
VHS,
is, right?
At the time Carl had that kit, there was no VHS rentals and all that. That came in the 80s, really. Mm-hmm. So Carl sold the kit around – he retired the kit around 78, 79. And then he ended up joining Asia. Yeah. And he was going to sell the drum kit at Sotheby's. And when the catalog got shipped, Ringo Starr saw the catalog and called Carl personally and said, will you sell this to me and take it out of the auction? And that's unprecedented for anybody to take something out of an auction, because once you give it to an auction house, you don't own it anymore,
right,
even though it had been auctioned. But it's Ringo and it's Sotheby's and it's Carl. And so next thing you know, the kit's withdrawn and Ringo owns it. So I hear through the reading the magazines, right? Somewhere in the early 80s, I'm reading Cream magazine that says Ringo Starr bought Carl Palmer's stainless steel kit and now has it for his son, Zach. And so I was, oh my God, wow, I'll never get it now. I mean, I couldn't afford it then by a long shot. And even if we sold our house, I couldn't have afforded that kit, which we weren't going to do. The bass drum's not big enough to sleep for.
Almost.
No, you're right. Almost, but not quite. That would have been a tough sell, even on my parents. And so then the kit sold to Ringo, one of the, you know, probably the wealthiest drummer in the world. So it's like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to keep my eye on it. So lo and behold, I end up working with Ringo. I build him a studio. And in that process, I kind of poke and prod if I can buy the kit. Because by now, I'm thinking, well, maybe I could afford the kit. Depends what he wants for it. But, you know, I certainly would like to explore it. He shut it down. This is early 2000s. He said, no, forget it.
I bought it. It's mine.
And don't ask me about it again. It was like that conversation was short. Mm. So I kept my ear to the ground. And in 2015, I call, and again, I can't tell you why. Why 2015? I had no updates or anything on the kit. But I called Don Bennett, who's a great drum, vintage drum and a rock star drum reseller and drummer himself. But he's like he and Steve Maxwell are like the go-to guys for, you're looking for a kit, and those are the guys that are the inside guys. And I called Don. I said, hey, do you have any way of finding out if – because he's tight with the Ringo camp. And I said, can you find out if this is possible now to buy? And he calls me back. He goes, you're not going to believe it. Ringo just consigned it to Julian's auction. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to call Darren Julian, and I'm going to do what Ringo did back in Sotheby's.
Yeah, good luck.
I'm going to buy it. Right, thank you. Well, you got to the end of the story, right? So David.
You're not Ringo. I love you, David. You're not Ringo.
Amen. Well, you can say that again.
I, there's nobody like Ringo. So.
No, there isn't. But Darren Julian said the same thing. Isn't that funny? Yeah. So he goes, I called Darren. Hey, talking to him, like, oh, you know, it's like you got this kid. And I give him the whole story. I'm 8 years old and I'm a cancer survivor. And like the whole, I meet Ringo, he won't sell it.
Oh, you pulled out all the stops.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, I didn't. I went for it. Remember,
shameless.
I'm not Ringo. I need every bullet in my gun.
Right.
So he listens. He goes, wow. He said, David, there is nobody in the world who should have this kit more than you. And I want you to know I really believe that. And I'm, Darren, thank you so much. That's exactly what I think, too. I'm so
blunt. you think he's going to say yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm so naive. I'm so, like, starstruck by this kit. And I'm like,
I'm like, oh, that's so kind. Thank you. I agree. Wow. You know, I, and he goes, but
good luck on Saturday when the auction starts.
He goes, but on December 5th, you will get to prove to the world that it belongs to you, because that's the day it's being auctioned. And there's no way we're taking it out of this auction. It's one of the key, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I tried. So the day comes, and I actually had to be out of the country that whole week, and including the day of the auction. And I was telling my best friend, Steven Sawitz, and Joe Stone Crab is an iconic restaurant in Miami. Probably it's the oldest and most iconic restaurant in the whole city. And we're having dinner one night, and he knows all about the kid anyway. And I'm telling him what's going on, and Darren, you know, telling me, thanks, but no thanks. And he goes, David, you're going to be out of the country, and you can phone bid, but what if you're like, you know, what if you're not reachable? Because I was going to be at a studio in the Caribbean. And so, like, the service, we're not, you know, it's not like I'm out of the country in, like, you know, Paris. I'm, like, out of the country in, like, a third world place. He's like, I'm going to fly to Beverly Hills and be the bidder in person for you if you drop off the call. Is that amazing? So he flies to L.A. and sits in the crowd to bid the drum set if my phone bidding call
fails. Doesn't. Right.
So it didn't. It turns out the phone bid worked in terms of, you know, it didn't drop the call, and I had my, because all day long the service was bad, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, come on, of all the days for this, you know, for this phone service down here to not work. But it ended up working, and I won the drum kit. And
okay, I gotta ask, how much?
Well, the price I paid was $75,000. The bid was 60, but they add 25%.
Yeah.
So I paid 75,000. But when you think that the bid ended at 60,000, it's just mind-boggling. That kit cost Carl more than that in 1972 and 73 dollars.
Really?
Never mind.
Oh, because it's an original single creation, one of a kind. Yeah.
And it was made by British Steel, who don't even make drum kits.
No.
So everything about it was completely custom, top of the line. Now it's owned not only by Carl Palmer, my drumming hero, but the most iconic drum hero in rock, Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
There's no way this drum kit's going to go for anything under a couple of hundred thousand, because it's worth that in the blink of an eye. It's never going to go for less than that. And the day before, Ringo sold his Ed Sullivan kit, which obviously is, you know,
oh,
the most
that's iconic the, drum yeah, kit. Right? Yeah.
So you can't. I'm not comparing.
No.
But it did sell in the same auction the day before for $2.2 million. So I'm thinking, oh, no. And it was Jim Irsay. They announced it. First thing I asked Steve in the audience, I'm like, look around. Is Irsay there? Just let me know. Should I start crying? So he's like, I don't see him. You know, like, oh, well, I hope not. So fortunately, I got it. And it's a dream come true.
Yeah, that's it. So, okay, another question is, do you know what Ringo bought it from Carl for?
No, I don't. I'll have to ask Carl. I don't.
Yeah,
I
didn't. We'll have to see what the markup was after 25 years.
Yeah, right. That's a great question. I'm going to ask him. But, you know, getting Carl to how I met Carl is Steve Maxwell, who I was mentioning, the vintage drum dealer, he is a friend of Carl's. And he called Carl and said, look, because Carl knew about the kit being auctioned. It was big in the drumming world. This was like – you know, this is like the huge headline. This was the talk of the town. The whole auction was, because it's Ringo's auction. But then, you know, it had his iconic Ed Sullivan kit, and it had the Palmer kit and a few others. So the drumming world, Carl Palmer world, all it was just buzzing, buzzing, buzzing.
Yeah.
It was actually a Facebook page that Rick Jones started that Carl Palmer's drum kit belongs in a museum. And he was trying to raise money to bid in it. And he was going to try to put it in a public place. So like the drum kit had a Facebook fan page. It had more Facebook fans than I have, right? The drum kit.
Yeah.
So this was really electrifying. Yeah. So Carl knew about it. And Carl Palmer's manager, Bruce Pilato, who's also an amazing guy, he knew about it because he's actually following it online. And, you know, that's his world. And so Steve calls Carl and says, look, the guy that bought the kit is kind of an interesting guy. And he has kind of a cool story, and I really think you guys should talk. Well, of course, we became fast friends, And, you know, 6 months later, we're doing a drum duet, producing a DVD together, doing a live concert, and the rest is history. And now we collaborate, and he was kind enough to write the foreword, and he's a big supporter of the projects that I do, and I'm still his biggest fan.
Yeah, I just wish the other two members were still around, that they could get out there and do their thing.
Absolutely, 100%. And in fact, the concert that we did in that June was a tribute to Keith.
Yeah.
Because in between our planning the concert and the concert itself, Keith, of course, left our world in that March.
Yeah.
I believe. Yeah. I don't remember the exact date off the top of my head, but it was right then. And so the whole, you know, the whole sentiment changed, you know, towards, of course, Carl was like, we're going to pay tribute to Keith. We're going to make this a really amazing concert and really pay tribute to his legacy. And we did. And it's out on DVD. You know, we're really proud of it. It came out really well. It's a really, really great concert. Anybody who's a Carl Palmer or ELP fan would really enjoy it.
Right, right. All right, so what is the simplest kit in the book?
The simplest kit?
Yeah.
Well, it's probably Mitch Mitchell's kit from Jimi Hendrix that it's like a 3 or 4 piece kit.
From the experience.
Buddy Rich's kits were all small. Those were all 5 piece. Mm-hmm. And he would always jokingly say, I only have the second floor, Tom, the 5th piece to put my towel on. Right? And then he plays the drums and sounds like there's 900 drums and you couldn't figure out one thing he's done the whole night, and it's only one night, right? And he plays every night of the year. Yeah. So he was the most amazing drummer ever, who's a huge – and Buddy was Carl's main influence.
Yeah.
And I think it's accurate to refer to Carl as the Buddy Rich of rock, because I really think Carl did take what Buddy did and practice and learn and apply it to his own musical ideas and then, you know, bring that to rock.
Yeah, as Buddy did from Gene Krupa, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. And you look at Sonny Payne and, like, how that whole world evolved is really amazing. So, but those would be some of the smaller kits. And then you have Terry Bozzio's 90-piece kit.
I was going to say, the most extravagant.
Yeah, I think he wins the prize. I think he even gets more than Neil Peart's R30 kit. Yeah. I think
This is Terry Bozzio.
Frank Zappa, yeah. Miss Wilson's in UK.
Yeah, yeah. I want to bring up that a bit. In fact, and I want to combine it with another drum kit that you have in there, because there are some interesting little combinations that if you look deeply in the book and you turn the pages several times, you'll begin to pick up. One of which is Terry Bozzio and Vinnie Caliuta, both of Frank Zappa, both having played the Black Page, which is considered like one of the most insane musical compositions ever. Explain to our listeners what the Black Page means and why those two are included in the drum book.
Well, the Black Page is so significant that Terry Bozzio and DW actually put out a snare drum a year ago that's the Black Page commemorative snare drum, and it actually has the Black Page notation of the drum part all around the snare drum as the art of it. And of course it says the Black Page with the Frank Zappa logo. So that's the end of the story of like just how iconic and significant that is. How it became that is Frank Zappa was listening to a lot of classical music, but he was writing, of course, his rock, you know, temp, you know, it's just a whole kind of potpourri of different ideas.
Always Frank, yeah, potpourri is a great example, a great use of a metaphor, right?
And he wanted to make a drum part that had so much drumming in it and was so complex and challenging to play that when you put all the notes on the page, it just looked like a black page, because as we know, notes are black and they're usually on white notation paper.
Right.
And so you put all these black notes and all you saw was black because there were so many notes. And so that's why he called it the Black Page, is that it just filled the page with notes. And so he wrote this incredibly complex piece. He gave it to Terry Bozzio. Bozzio worked on it, as he says, I'm recounting the story from Terry, that he worked on it for a week, and learned it and played it. And Frank was really happy because at first Frank wasn't even sure it was playable by a drummer. That's
probably Frank going, I'm going to fuck with him now.
Right, exactly. So it took a week for Terry Bozzio to learn it. Well, Caliuta comes into his audition and the folklore is, and I believe it by the way, because Vinny's one of the greatest drummers in history. Mm-hmm. The folklore is he sight read it. He sits down and he sight reads the black page.
Never looked at it before. Just walked in.
Well, I'm sure he would shed it.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It was on record, but never looked at the actual, didn't have the notation and was not sitting there with Frank's band in an audition. And now he's got to play the black page. I mean, that's a whole nother thing. And he did.
Wow. Pretty amazing. Yeah. Both our kits are in there. So,
well, and that's a great point. That's a great point, because if you look at it, you got two of the Kiss drummers.
Yep.
Peter, Chris, and Eric Singer. You got two of the Zappa drummers. Mm-hmm. You know, you got Louie Belson and Buddy Rich, who are like the one, two, you know, most famous big band and, you know, kind of drummers. So, and Joe Morello, of course. So you got like different categories depending on you know, what we're doing.
Well, I want to bring up another one. And that is, I mean, obviously you cannot talk drumming as we already mentioned without starting with Mr. Starkey, and the interesting thing is both are in there. But we'll first talk about the elder Mr. Starr, without doubt the most influential drummer in the history of recorded music, though many people may not realize it. Some undereducated folks don't realize the amazing work Ringo did, which is just mind-blowing when you think of it as a musician. We here at the Rock and Roll Archaeology are huge fans of Ringo. So tell us about the Ludwig kits and why they're so special. In fact, I think Ringo gets five different setups in the book, and the only other drummer who gets that is Carl Palmer.
Well, I agree with you about Ringo. That is a fact. And so Gary Astridge is Ringo's historian for his drum history. I've met Gary. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, great guy and a great friend of mine. And when you're Ringo, you have a drum historian, right? I can't say I know one.
Is there anybody else who has a drum historian?
No, I've never heard of it. But it's, you know.
Well deserved.
It fits the Ringo perfectly. So Gary, you know, of course, I don't own the Ringo kits. They're valued at anywhere. You know, one's $2.2 million, the other one's
we know that. Million. That's an established fact, right?
Right. So, and the other ones have not been sold. Mm-hmm. So, I was talking to Gary, and he talked to Ringo, and Ringo said, "I have pictures of he had done nothing to do with Crash at the time." He had just done a professional photo shoot of these drum kits that he had, of each of the kits. And they're all the kits that he used in the Beatles, from day one to the rooftop.
Yeah, which, by the way, happened 50 years ago yesterday.
I know, of course. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you know it. Mm-hmm. So that was, so Gary got the pictures from Ringo, and we put them in the book, of course.
It's amazing. And the other interesting thing is that because the book is done in alphabetical order, there's Richard Starkey and his son Zach right next to each other.
Yep. So no one can say – it's already hard enough for people in some cases to say, well, why this drummer and why that kit? And some of the kits I wanted that would have been in that book don't exist anymore. Like I've been pretty diligent in trying to find certain kits, and it's like, you know, some of them have been dismantled, some of them have been destroyed, some of them have been sold and dismantled. You know, there's like a whole story behind every one you can imagine. So there's a lot of significance in even having one really remarkable kit. They're very hard to obtain in the first place for all those reasons. So, you know, we decided let's do it in alphabetical order. So it's like really fair, you know, and try to put the rhyme and reason to everything. So you can just, you know, if you want to find a drummer, and it happens all the time, people reach out to me and they say they love it. So they want to show somebody a drummer. you know exactly where to go. You're not trying to think what decade. You know, we could have done it a lot of different ways. Rock, jazz, you know. But it's like
chronological, it's so, yeah, or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just know exactly where to go. So that worked out really well. And then, of course, Zach being his son, I have the Super Bowl kit that he played.
With the Who.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the one and only Who Super Bowl they did. He had a clear kit. Mm-hmm. And London painted symbols that Zildjian did just for him, just for that show.
Yes, I've been to the Zildjian factory. I've seen a couple of them.
I have too. Isn't that the most amazing experience when you go to the Zildjian factory? To me, that's one of the greatest memories I've ever had.
We did a podcast for them on their history. I mean, their history is just incredible. I mean, it's a 400-year-old, almost 500-year-old company owned by the same family.
Went to Norwell.
Yes, went to Norwell.
And went to Longwater Drive or whatever that is, and you went into the factory, building.
with all the kits in the waiting room there, I was there for 2 days, and we did a lot of research and went through the whole thing, and it's amazing. It's amazing to pick up the preforms and then hit a stick to it and hear the ring from this unformed piece of metal that just immediately it's a symbol. It's crazy. The formula is a family secret. Only two people in the world are allowed to know it at any time. So, of course, now it's run by Craigie Zildjian. And so, yeah, we did the whole thing.
Awesome.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I have great memories of the Zildjian factory. I've visited it a few times, different intervals in my life, and it's always just...
Yeah, again, Boston. Yeah, a Boston kid. I can imagine you probably drove by for years just looking at it before they allowed you in, huh?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I went there when I was a teenager at first through a music store connection that I had. I had nothing going on in my career that got me there at that moment. I was like 15, but they were just being really kind and nice, which show what kind of people they are.
Yes.
And then, of course, later on, it was a different story. And I went there, at the invitation of, the drummer from Kiss, Eric Singer, and, people that are significant endorsees of theirs. Mm-hmm. And they were aware of my career at that point. So it kind of evolved. But the story that's funny of what you just said is that, no exaggeration, to get to Joe Perry and Steven Tyler's house from my house, which I drove for over 10 years down Route 3A, you have to drive by the Zildjian factory.
Grim. That's amazing.
So I've driven by that factory thousands of times. And of course, only went in a couple, but I literally, yes, just that was the route. Just a fluke. They lived south of the Zildjian factory and I lived north of it. So, and it was a one way to get there and that was it. So crazy.
That's crazy. Okay. So how many kits are included in the book?
It's a good question. I think over 50.
And how many of these are part of the Hit the Deck Drum Experience Center in South Florida?
All of them.
Than the Ringo ones.
Right, yes, yeah. Of course.
Other than the Ringo ones, these are all owned by you.
Yes, the foundation. Yes, we have all those kits other than Ringo. And we're, because it's an active foundation, we're buying and selling. There's every project, every goal has, especially something like this, every goal has a kind of a beginning, a middle, and then it's run to its evolutions and hopefully not an end. But the beginning is just a few years old, right? My drumming career is old, but collecting all the kits is 5 to 10 years of collecting. It's kind of the beginning. Mm-hmm. So now we're kind of entering that middle part. So in doing that, you start to realize, how much space do you have? What do you want to dedicate that space to? What are the kits that you really want to keep and that are really going to function within the foundation and within the museum? What are the kits that we'd be better off letting somebody else enjoy, using that money for programming, using that money for a different kit? So so now we're starting to enter that. So it's changing, and it'll be cool because when it transforms to the next level, there'll be a crash volume too.
That I am certain of.
Yeah.
I am certain of that. Okay, so, you know, we can't hit all the drum sets in here. It was just virtually impossible. But I had to pull out a favorite. You know, you kind of hit on this in the book, and that's, you know, in the 60s, I think, you know, the virtuoso drummer is probably Ginger Baker, maybe Mitch Mitchell, one of those guys. Definitely in the 70s, it's Carl Palmer. And in the 80s, it's this guy. The guy all drummers I was around as a kid growing up would, they would shake their heads in amazement or try too desperately to sound like him. The only drummer were in a concert once I literally was on the third deck, which wasn't often. I could see hundreds of drummers in the audience with glow sticks following his every move, and that is the professor, Neil Peart. In the book, you have the R30 drum kit. And I don't want to talk about the kit so much. People can buy the book and they can look that up, but I want to get your thoughts on that, you know, the athleticism of drumming, especially once you get to the harder rock or prog rock, and the toll it takes, the physicality. Obviously, I bring this up because, you know, as we all know now, Neil has completely retired from drums.
Yeah, that's right. For that reason, that's the reason he retired, because of physical toll it was taking.
Yeah, it's to play drums in that manner is a sporting event in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. It really is, because what a lot of people don't realize is that when you're sitting on a stage in a large arena or stadium playing the drums and getting the sound you want for the audience to hear is a very different experience, requires a very different skill set than just playing in your practice room. And it's not logical, because you think, well, what's the difference? You're playing the kit, same kit, it's a different room, you get up on the stage, just play the same thing. It just doesn't translate that way. The way the microphones pick up, the way that your interaction with the audience, the way that the acoustics in these places are, you have to really, really play hard. Mm-hmm. Even with the speed and finesse that Neil Peart has, and we all know one of the greatest drummers ever and always will be, there's just a tremendous amount of sound that needs to come out of the drums from your hitting the drum. And it's very, very physical. And it's because of the kinds of places he's playing, especially. So it has played. And he's, you know, he did that for 40 years. And it's just, and like you said, you go to it's the only concert that I've ever been to where you see 12,000 Tom Sawyer fills plus the guy on the
stage.
All
at the same time, right?
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
12,000 perfect fills.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty amazing. And it's sad that some of our heroes have to do this. But, you know, again, if you look at it like a professional athlete, hey, the day comes when you have to hang it up. They all do. You know, Neil just feels the same way. And, you know, knowing a little bit about the man himself and the other pursuits that he has, he'll be just fine without it. So, all right. So I got to ask, what's your kit today? What's the top and the bottom that you're using?
Well, I've been using the two kits. My favorite kit is a Yamaha Phoenix kit, and they've stopped making the Phoenix kit. But it's just my favorite kit, and I can't imagine that I'll find a kit that sounds a whole lot better anytime soon. So that's my day-to-day kit. And I also want to mention about Neil, to kind of finish that, about, you know, the athletic comparison is so perfect. And I want to say
that. Because you experience it yourself.
Oh, 1,000%. And I've seen him play many, many times, and 100% I've experienced it, and it's absolutely true. But in the case of Neil, he has left us with an incredible legacy of content. He did at least two that I can think of right off the top of my head. There might be three. I don't remember. Full-on multi-DVD learning videos.
Yeah, yeah. Here's how I did it, kids.
Right. Right. I mean, think about that. That, and not to mention the content from Rush. There's hundreds of live video recordings between professional recordings and YouTube and everywhere else. I mean, there's so much content on this man's playing. But even more than that, you know, with the gifts that he left us, with all of those how-tos. He really did it all. And he's wrote, you know, he's an author as well of, you know, some great books of his travels and his passion for traveling around the country on his motorcycle. And so there's a lot. I say that and I add that to our talk today because there's a lot of people that would really be inspired by checking out all that's out there. There's really years of content to experience. And so even though Neil's not around to play in the flesh anymore, there's still a lot of Neil for us to be inspired by.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a little rumor going around. It's not really a rumor. Mike Portnoy said it himself, but he said, I'll take the position in a heartbeat. So, yeah, again, he's in the book as well.
I read that. He is in the book. Thank you. But you're right. He did say that. And that's an interesting proposition. Yeah. I mean, we'll see
we'll see how that happens.
Yeah.
So all of these kits are acoustic. Did you consider including anyone's electronic setup? And that begs the question, with so much music being done on computer nowadays, while it's a great moment for beats, it doesn't seem to be for live drums.
Well, that's a great point. As far as electronic drums in the kit, no, I didn't, because there really wasn't anything that represented, you know, I wanted the book to really be on point. Yeah. And so, you know, there's plenty of pictures out there, Simmons kits and some of the, you know, the Roland kits and some of the most significant kits electronically. And I don't think they're incredibly interesting to go back and look at. But maybe to talk about.
Maybe they don't have the artisanal beauty that you find in those acoustic instruments.
No, they don't. And I don't know why you would want to go back all the time unless you were referencing something. But to actually experience the kit in like the cool coffee table, like you sit down with your kids and go through it and just see if they're moved, right? Mm-hmm. See if there's inspiration. You don't even have to read a word of it. So I wanted the book to really convey that energy and that rock and roll, even with the jazz kits, that rock and roll energy that the drums naturally have, right? I mean, like you said, it's like an athlete. You watch Michael Jordan, like there's no such thing as watching him too many times.
No.
Right? So it's the same thing with these great drummers and drum kits. But maybe in a Crash Volume 2, there'll be more of an electronic element in some way. Maybe we'll take some of the iconic drum machines that I have.
I can't wait for the picture of the Lynn drum.
Well, it's so iconic.
These are now. They are becoming collectors in their own right.
Without a doubt. And drum machines are a different story from drum kits. So those do have a cool place in the whole history, and I think they belong in a book. And it's funny that a guy whose entire life has been always attached to electronics and technology and even within drums, triggering and doing all these cool things, has a completely organic drum. It's like, what? Hey, that's what it is. That's what the vision is and was.
Well, to bring up Neil Peart one more time, you know, it's Hemispheres.
Yes, I love it. Now, you can't bring up Neil Peart too many times. But you really can't. You know, old joke, how many drummers does it take to screw in a light bulb? 10. 1 to do it and 9 to say how Neil Peart would have done it.
Heard that one. That's
Neil Peart is... He is in the top five.
The closest thing to a drum machine.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, just – and every night. I remember seeing him 2 shows on the same tour, and everything he played both nights was absolutely the same except for the few places where he had some creative freedom and they weren't like iconic drum parts, which most of what he played was. Once it was on the record, it was like that's what it was.
Yeah.
But there were some parts in the show where he had a few places he could do something different, especially in the solo. And I just remember thinking after the second show, and they were days apart, and I'm thinking, this is the most remarkable thing I think I've ever seen, because I just watched a man play in front of 16,000 people 2 nights. Every single thing he played that he needed to play perfectly and like the record, he did both nights as if it were the same show, that perfect. And then the few places he could take creative freedom, he blew my mind with new ideas that fit in exactly the perfect place at the perfect time. And I think that was truly the closest I ever came to saying, what the hell am I doing drumming? It's already done. It's already there. You know what? I'm going to put the sticks down and just watch Neil Peart for the rest of my life. No, I'm too driven to do that. But it was that phenomenal. And I hope a lot of people experienced it, because he really, if you didn't, you got to see the videos, because he really is that great.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to see Rush probably. I think there's only one other band that I've seen more than Rush throughout my life. You know, it's a sad moment to think that, you know, he won't be there. Luckily, he's still around. That's fantastic. But, you know, it is an experience in music that I don't think will be repeated. So, all right, final question. Desert Island, you only get one kit from the book, at least today, and I'm sure it changes every day. Which one is it and why?
Carl Palmer stainless steel kit.
Yeah, the one that kind of started it all, right?
Totally, and still makes my blood flow faster and be completely inspired and changed my life. And it's absolutely something that, you know, that's it. That's the kit.
Well, David, I'm going to have to get down to South Florida and visit Hit the Deck Drum Experience in the not too distant future.
Please do.
You know, it's been fantastic talking with you today. I know we touched on a few things going on in your incredibly busy life. There's so much more that we could talk about, so we'll just have to have you back on another time. But, you know, so really, David Frangione, thank you so much for being on Deeper Digs in Rock today.
Well, thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to share the stories with you and with all the listeners. My goal, anytime that I have the privilege of a conversation like this, is to just hope that, you know, everybody can take at least one thing away of value. So hopefully, you know, at the very least, some of the stories, but maybe some of the history and some of the great references that people can check out, and, you know, maybe that they haven't before, or listen to it or see it from a different angle, and, you know, just make life better.
We will talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Wow, a lot learned from Gyro Gearloose, or known to all beyond the Demon of Screamin' Steven Tyler, David Frangione. Oh, what a great guy. We had a lot of fun, and I sincerely hope you all did as well. And such a good time, in fact. We spoke for much longer afterwards, so there are a few special choice cuts we will release out later for you. Yeah, we do a fair amount of drum shows on Deeper Digs in Rock, probably because our early relationship with the Avidus Zildjian Company. But I'm very proud of talking to these guys and gals who drive a band. You know, as Buddy Rich famously said, an average band with a great drummer sounds great. A great band with an average drummer sounds average. And as a working musician myself, I completely agree. That guy on the throne, in the back, banging on the bongos like a chimpanzee, is the heart of any band. If you've got one, treat him nice. Okay, go out and get Crash, the world's greatest drum kits, from A Piece to Van Halen, by our friend David Frangione, wherever you get your fine books. And if you do need a special gift, especially for a drummer, give them this and they will thank you for it. I guarantee it. Okay, that's all for this week. I'm Christian Swain, the Rock and Roll Archaeologist. Until next time, keep up the rockin'. We'll be right back.
Hey diggers, Christian Swain here with a short pause for a great cause. We believe music education for young people is an investment in a better future for all of us. If you listen to our podcasts, chances are you agree. Little Kids Rock has transformed the lives of more than 650,000 public school students by bringing music education into their schools. Little Kids Rock trains teachers in underfunded schools to teach kids the music they love, from the Beatles to Bruno Mars, Led Zeppelin to Lady Gaga, Chuck Berry to Chance the Rapper. Little Kids Rock has become a national movement to restore, expand, and innovate music education in public schools across America. Visit littlekidsrock.org and learn more about how you can help put music where it belongs, in our schools. Thank you, and let's keep up the rockin' right into the next generation.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Playlists can be found at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rnrap.com for more information.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.